Yeah, thanks a lot, Sabrina, for inviting me to give this talk and also, yeah, for the introduction. So I've basically chosen this very general title because I'm actually trying to talk about two kind of distinct topics. So let's see how this works now. I guess you can see the, yeah. So I'm going to give you a little introduction into the relation between quantum information and holography, of course. And then I will first talk about a very cute master thesis work of my back then master student Pablo Pastero here, where also Johanna was involved, and a couple more people, including Yanis Matea-Kagis, who is now a postdoc in Genova. And this is going to be about an attempt to understand the large n limit, not of qubit complexity, but of qdit complexity. So you have like an n level system, and we want to understand what is the large n limit of quantum complexity in this n level system. And it turns out that we can we found a reformulation for a particular choice of basically penalty factors in terms of two dimensional hydrodynamics on a torus. So this is going to be the first part of my talk. And then I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about another project that's very dear to my heart, namely symmetry solved entanglement in ADS CFT, and in particular in ADS 3 CFT 2. So this is basically a refined notion of entanglement entropy if you have additional conserved charges in your system. And so we wrote a couple of papers that I will just summarize briefly. Okay. Yeah. And if there are any questions, since this is supposed to be like an informal meeting, just interrupt me. Yeah, so just to set the stage, you know that in the last basically, yeah, by now 16 years, there has emerged this kind of triangle here between gravity, quantum field theory, and the theory of quantum information. So the relation between gravity and quantum field theory is given by the ADS-CFT correspondence, which I think I don't need to introduce to this audience here. And then it has turned out in since the seminal work of Ryo Takayanagi in 2006 that basically the ADS-CFT correspondence also relates quantities in quantum information theory that characterize the quantum information content of your states with objects in gravity. So we can either learn something about quantum information theory by studying objects in ADS gravity or the other way around. And of course, and this is something that probably quantum information people have overlooked for some time. It's interesting in its own right to study what is the quantum information content of your favorite quantum field theory state. Yeah. So in particular, there has been in 2010, there has been this interesting essay here by Mark van Ramsdonk, where he basically claimed that it should be possible to build up the dual holographic spacetime by studying the quantum information content of the dual quantum field theory state. Yeah. And so this kind of theme has been around ever since, and basically fleshing this out, understanding how this actually works is behind this general direction of studying quantum information ADS-CFT, and in particular also behind this talk here. So the main object of study so far, there are of course many other quantum information measures, but the main object has been the entanglement entropy. And so as you know very well, most probably this is a measure of bipartite quantum entanglement. So you split your system, let's say in the spatial way here, into subsystem A and subsystem B. And you need to make an assumption that the Hilbert space splits. You need to check this. And if this holds, then you can trace over the B Hilbert space in your density matrix here and get the reduced density matrix, and the entanglement entropy is then the Fonneumann entropy of this reduced density matrix, and it measures you how the state inside A is entangled with the state outside of A. If you do this, for example, for the EPR state, you get this famous log 2 entanglement entropy between the two qubits. So now how does this translate into ADS-CFT? So I guess I don't need to explain a lot about the ADS-3 CFT2 correspondence, but let me just state that. So this is a duality relation between in a simplifying limit between three-dimensional gravity, Einstein-Hilbert gravity with a negative cosmological constant. So this is minus 2 lambda here. And so the ground state is ADS-3 spacetime here. And the dual quantum field theory is basically defined via the correspondence on the boundary. And if you look carefully and do asymptotic symmetry analysis in the gravity theory, you find that the dual quantum field theory needs to have a particular symmetry, namely two-dimensional relativistic conformal symmetry here. So it has to it has this Virasoro symmetry here. The limit that's involved, that basically suppresses higher derivative corrections here, is the limit of large central charge, because from the work of Brown and Tenneau in 1986, we learned that the central charge here is related to the inverse Newton constant, and having the Newton constant small and hence the inverse Newton constant large means that we are suppressing quantum gravity corrections, which would lead to higher derivative corrections in the effective action. So now, what is the entanglement entropy in ADS3 CFD2? So this is this was figured out by Leo and Takanagi in 2006. So of course, they made a more general proposal for general dimensions. Their proposal is basically summarized here in this formula, namely what you have to do is you have to go to, at least for static spacetimes, you have to take a fixed time slice here, and then you have to consider your entangling interval A here, the subsystem that you're considering, and calculate the length of the minimal geodesic connecting these endpoints of the entangling interval U and V, or the endpoints here. And since this is formally infinite, this distance, one has to put a UV cutoff here. And this is the UV cutoff that's also necessary to calculate entanglement entropy from the field theory side. So at the end, if you do this, so there are two aspects here, of course. First of all, this is an additional test of the ADS-CFT correspondence, because you can do this calculation independent in gravity. And in a two-dimensional conformal field theory, I will not go into the details here. And so what happens is, if you do this in your favorite 2D relativistic CFT, then you find this result here that was first given by Holtze, Logic, and Wilson, and Cardi and Calabrese, namely that the entanglement entropy in the ground state is given by 1/3 the central charge times the logarithm of this distance between U and V here, yeah, the length of this entangling interval divided by this UV cutoff that you need to define this thing in the first place. And if you do the same calculation in gravity and you use the Brown-Hanau result, then you recover this particular result. Yeah, so it's a test that this proposal really works. This is one aspect, and the other aspect is you could now be tempted to try to put little small basically perturbations of space-time inside here inside your ADS spacetime, like put a little bit of curvature or put a black hole and so on, and you could try to reconstruct the bulk geometry by basically from the lengths of all possible geodesics, and hence from the lengths of all from the values of all possible entanglement entropies. Yeah, so this would be in line with Van Ramstorp's proposal that we can reconstruct the bulk spacetime by looking at the entanglement entropy on the boundary. Okay. Now, does this work? Well, it has been pointed out, in fact, in a paper by Susskind that was titled "Entanglement is Not Enough," that this doesn't work. Yeah, and there are several ways to understand this. One way is to understand this is the insight that there exist entanglement shadows. So there are regions in space in particular space times, like for example the black hole in ADS3. That you cannot probe with the Ryo Takayanagi geodesic, yeah, and basically the RT geodesic cannot enter the horizon of the BTC black hole, yeah. So in order to probe the space time inside the horizon, one needs another object. And people have tried this. There's this paper by Hartmann Maldacena from 2013, where he basically looked at the, maybe I should draw a picture here, since this is supposed to be before I explain these pictures here. So where they basically calculated the entanglement entropy in the two-sided black hole in three dimensions, for example. So basically, this is the Penrose diagram here of the BTC black hole in three dimensions, and so they basically showed that if you if you fix a time slice here and a time slice here, so this is where your state is defined, and then you look at particular nice slices that go through the black hole here, then you can basically go ahead and calculate the entanglement entropy for an interval chosen on this side, on this time slice here, and another interval here. And the Ryotake-Nagi prescription basically tells you that you have to find the minimal length geodesic to connect these endpoints. So there are two phases. There's the connected phase, and then there is the disconnected phase here, which does not enter the horizon actually. So it turns out that if you go ahead and you want to probe here the interior of the black hole, basically by doing time evolution on both sides in this direction, then it turns out that you cannot probe all the region inside the black hole by this entanglement entropy that's given by the length of these geodesics, because as you go up in time, the length of this of these geodesics becomes longer and longer, and at some point this phase takes over because you have to find the minimal geodesic, and hence this two-sided entanglement entropy is also not a good probe of the inside of the black hole. Yeah. Are there any questions? Yeah. So how am I doing with time? Quite well. Yeah. So what Susskind realized is that one needs another object to probe the inside of these black hole space times, and he proposed that one should look at a dual to what is called quantum complexity in ADS-CFT. So basically in 2014 and 2015, they gave two proposals of, I will explain in a second what quantum complexity is, but so basically they gave two proposals of what should be the dual to the so-called quantum complexity. One is this complexity equals volume proposal that states that the quantum complexity of the state, basically of this time evolution of the state, in the two-sided black hole here that we are considering, is dual to the volume of the maximal space-like slice here, and the other proposal was that instead of the volume, one could also use the on-shell action in the so-called Wheeler-DeWitt patch here, which is this causally connected patch here that ends on these two. On these two boundary slices, yeah, and so there is a certain arbitrarity. There's a certain arbitrarity in choosing the holographic dual to this quantum computational complexity. And in fact, recently, Rob Myers and collaborators have shown that there are actually many more definitions that fulfill basic requirements of this quantum computational complexity. So which I will explain in a second. So what is this quantum complexity? The basic question is, if I want to build a quantum computer, it's usually a system that implements, let's say, n qubits, and so I'm working on a Hilbert space of dimension 2 to the n. And so the question is, can I, given a set of simple unitary operations that act on my state, can I build any general state, and how complex is this operation? Yeah, so basically one starts out with a set of gates, UI. This set has to be universal in the sense that you can build you can act consecutively on a simple starting state psi zero, let's say, and get to any state in the Hilbert space. Yeah. Or in other words, you can implement any unitary operator U by building it up from consecutive products of these gates. Yeah. And then this quantum computational complexity is the question, what is the minimal number of gates that you need to build a given unitary operator, which is an element of SU2 to the n. So now at the end, it turns out that this problem of finding this minimal number of gates can be attacked by looking at geometry basically on the SU2 to the N manifold. So basically, this is Nielsen's approach to quantum complexity. Basically, you put a particular metric on the SU2 to the N group, and then the question of what is the minimal number of gates to reach a given unitary translates into finding the minimal length curve, so the geodesic between the unit operator and this U that you want to produce. Yeah, and so Nielsen has been has shown in several works in 2005 to 2007 that you can basically use the concept of Finsler geometry, which is some generalization of Riemannian geometry that I will not explain in detail now, and what is called Hamiltonian control theory to figure out basically general scaling arguments of this for this length and hence for the complexity. And one result of is that basically this the length of this geodesic and hence this quantum computational complexity. If you build the so basically what happens is if you want to hit this unitary U here by starting from the unit operator, then you have to give an element in the algebra here that sets your starting direction and velocity, which you know in which you go down on the along this geodesic here. So this is like the control Hamiltonian, and so once you rewrite this target unitary in terms of the exponential map involving this control Hamiltonian, then you can show that the length of this curve scales linearly in time for a long time, and the prefactor is actually the number of the of qubits that you're working with here. So this linear scaling here in evolution time basically has was the so this was the basis for Susskind et al.'s proposals of these holographic dual to complexity, because both these objects, the volume of this maximal slice and the on-shell action on the Velo de Witt patch scale linearly in evolution time as you go up here, yeah, on both sides in time evolution. Yeah.
Okay. So the way you define complexity depends on the choice of what are the unit operations, right?
Yes.
But so you're saying that this behavior, which is that it grows linearly in time, is
this is independent. This is independent, basically. Yeah. Other details depend on the choice of gate, like for example, with which precision. There's a little more to Nielsen's work. So you're basically building up the unitary operator from small building blocks. And so typically if you take a general unitary, you can only reach this in like a series of an infinite series of operations. So you have to give some kind of accuracy goal, how far you can go, how close you want to go to the unitary that you aim at. This depends on the choice of gates in some sense. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you find differential complexity in a CFT discontinuous PT?
This is a very good question. If you want to know more about this, you should ask Annalena, for example. She has written some papers on this. So basically, what's happening, and of course Johanna, so basically what's happening is I don't want to talk about works that I was not involved here, but so basically you have to find a proper set of gates. And so what Annalena, Johanna and collaborators did was you basically start out in a Verma module, and then you go to your particular state by acting, which is a descendant state, typically by acting with the Virasoro descendant operators. And so the Virasoro descendant operators are your gates in this case. That's one definition you can do.
For 2D CFT or for
another? For 2D CFT, yeah.
Because if you don't have a definition of what is complexity on the left hand side and right hand side, the gravitational side and the CFT side.
Yes, this is what we are aiming at here a little bit. It's an open problem, yeah.
The use of it.
Yeah.
It's an unsolved problem.
It depends, of course, again, yeah, as you probably anticipate, on the choice of gates and what and the choice of gate depends on the theory you're looking at, if you ask about the general quantum field theory and so on.
Yeah.
I think it's not solved. For 2D CFTs, there are these proposals using the Virasoro generators by Johanna, Annalena, and collaborators and other people as well. And yeah, it's an unsolved problem. Yes. So any other questions? Okay. So the important one. Basically this I will explain a little later where this linear and time evolution time scaling really comes from. But so just keep this in mind for now. Yeah. Yeah. No, I will not explain a little later. I will explain this now. So this linear and evolution time scaling of the complexity basically comes from the following. You can understand this in the following way. So the SU2 to the N group is a compact space. It's a compact manifold, right? And this long time scaling turns out to be actually, it happens for exponential times in the number of, basically in your Hilbert space dimension, so in the dimension of this group. And you can understand this in terms of ergodicity. So basically the geodesic motion on this group manifold here is ergodic, which means that as you go down in one direction and you wait long enough, then your geodesic will come close to any given point on your group manifold in some time. Yes. And so basically the length of this geodesic scales linearly for this very long time. Yeah. Now, this, of course, cannot go on forever because this is a compact manifold. So at some point, you have to come back to some point that you already visited, and then your geodesics ceases to be minimal there. And so when this happens, then you basically hit a conjugate point. Yeah. So at the end, the time evolution of complexity has this very long linear growth, and then it levels off. Okay. Once you hit a conjugate point. So you need both ergodic behavior for the motion on your group manifold, and you need these conjugate points. So these two requirements turn out to be also good requirements for holographic complexity measure, because you can argue. So first of all, Susskind et al. Showed that there is this linear growth in these complexity measures, but at some point this will also stop. Yeah. So there is basically. So basically at some point the volume, for example, of this time slice will not keep growing. And so these are basically good necessary requirements for good holographic complexity measure. And ergodicity does depend. So whether you're ergodic in your motion here on your manifold a priori might depend. Or will depend on what metric you're choosing, right? So you're calculating a geodesic on this group manifold. You need to give a metric on this group manifold, and it turns out that so this metric is actually telling you which directions basically on the group manifold are easier to reach and which are harder to reach, which are further away, and this basically tells you which gates are easy to implement in your quantum computer and which are harder to implement, right? Because the gates depend on are basically different directions you can go into on this group manifold. Yeah.
Sorry, CMS yeah. is exponential.
It's exponential in the dimension of the Hilbert space, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Good. So whether you're ergodic in the gravitational case, I think it's basically e to the entropy of the black hole. So I will discuss some conditions later for ergodicity and the existence of conjugate points. So what we set out in this project to do is basically the following. So we wanted to look at the large n limit, not on the SU2 to the n group here, which would be the proper group of unitaries that acts on n qubits, but on the SUn group, which is the group of unitaries that act on what is called a qdit. So it's like an n level system. Yeah. So we investigated this large n limit, and in particular, several aspects of. So we investigated this large n limits and in limit, and in particular we investigated whether conditions for this existence of ergodicity and conjugate points are fulfilled, and also whether we can rewrite in a particular simple way the dynamics of this of the geodesic motion, and we found out that yes, it can be rewritten in terms of basically two-dimensional incompressible hydrodynamics on a torus. I will explain this in the following. Yeah. Good. So let me first explain what is different in our approach to the standard approaches that have been investigated by Nielsen and other people. So basically, as I already said before, what people do is they think of building a quantum computer in terms of a number of qubits. So let's say the quantum computer at Google has 50 something qubits, and then they understand that operations, the gates that they can implement in this quantum computer typically act on a single qubit or two qubits maybe, but that's it. Yeah, they don't want to implement operations that act on 17 qubits at the same time, and so their minimal set of gates is restricted to 2 and 3 qubit operations, let's say. And so what they have to do in terms of this geometric approach of Nielsen here, on the SU2 to the N manifold, they have to put a metric that penalizes all the higher qubit operations. Yes, so there are so-called penalty factors involved, and these are basically the eigenvalues of the metric that you put on a group manifold, and this scales exponential in the number of qubits involved in this operation. Okay. So if you now make the number of qubits very large, then you're basically penalizing. So M is the number of qubits that are involved in your operation. And so you see that these penalty factors, and hence the underlying metric, diverges very badly, namely exponentially. Yeah. So what's happening is basically the metric that you put on your group manifold becomes singular in some bad way. Okay. And so this is actually what we changed in our work. So we are working with qubit operations, but we don't penalize exponentially. So in a sense, we are describing the quantum computational complexity of a quantum computer that is a little more advanced, that has, let's say, I don't know, you know, qubits with dimension 500 or something as fundamental building blocks, and we assume that it's possible to go and make, you know, do operations that act on 237 of those at the same time. Yeah, so we basically use a distribution of penalty factors which is not exponential in the number of levels involved here, but that only grows quadratically. This choice of penalty factors, and hence this choice of metrics, basically descends from the Laplacian acting on the group manifold. I will explain that later. Okay, so this is the main difference, and so you can imagine that since our metric does not diverge so strongly in the limit of in the large n limit, that we will be able to find some kind of effective description of the geodesic motion and hence of quantum computational complexity. Good. So that's the starting point. And the first thing, you know, once you give a metric, put a metric on your group manifold, the first thing that you can check that we checked is the large n limit. That's
the same thing, right?
Not really, because m here is the number of qubits involved, and here k is basically the distance between the levels. I will discuss in a second what k really is. Okay, So the first thing we did is to investigate the curvatures on the SUN manifold. Sorry, this is a typo here. In the large n limit. So why did we investigate the curvatures of this manifold with our choice of metric? The reason is basically that the curvatures tell us whether these properties, ergodicity and conjugate points, are actually fulfilled. Yeah. So you can think of it in the following way, roughly speaking. If you make this SUN manifold very large, you have many directions to go into with your geodesic motion. Yeah. And so if sufficiently many of these directions are actually locally negatively curved, yeah, then the geodesic motion will be chaotic. Yeah. So nearby geodesics will diverge exponentially. And if you have chaotic behavior in your dynamical system, you typically have ergodicity. Okay. So basically ergodicity and so chaotic behavior and hence ergodicity needs negative curvature, so we should have sufficiently many negatively curved directions. And on the other hand, the existence of conjugate points, the points where the geodesic comes back to its original to to a place that it has visited before needs some positive curvatures. This is a mathematical theorem from differential geometry. Yeah. So we basically tried to check several kinds of curvatures. So we started out checking the distribution of sectional curvatures on the SUN manifold with our choice of metric in the large n limit. So this can be only done numerically because the number of sectional curvatures grows quite fast as n grows large, and so this is the result here. So we found that there is a well-defined stabilizing distribution in the large n limit of the sectional curvatures given in this plot here. So blue is the percentage of positively curved directions, red is the percentage of negatively curved directions, and green is the percentage of flat directions, and you see it nicely stabilizes. So there is some well-defined large n limit in this distribution, and so this is our first result in this paper. Now, unfortunately, this is not enough to say something about whether the motion, the geodesic motion, is already chaotic or not, because
the metric you're using is not the SUN metric.
There is what you're thinking about is probably the standard metric that's left and right invariant and that descends from the Killing inner product. No, that's not. Ours is only left invariant. I will show you in a second. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So basically there exists if you go into the mathematical literature, there is a theorem that tells you if all the sectional curvatures are negative, then you're surely chaotic and hence ergodic. Not much else is known if you really check for theorems that relax this assumption. Okay, so this is not good enough. We have a lot of directions that are negatively curved, but not all of them. Yeah. So what we've done.
Sorry, I think I'm.
Yeah.
What do we do with this metric? So we define a metric.
So what you do is you define a metric. So let's say this is the SUN manifold. You define a metric that must be at least left or right invariant under the group action. So it represents it respects the group symmetry. Yeah. No, you can. I will show you in a second. Okay. I'm just talking. First, talking about the curvatures, and then I will show you this metric and the relation to hydrodynamics. Okay. So you have some metric here on this manifold. And then this is a very big manifold, so you basically, if you want, the sectional curvatures are basically the independent entries in the Riemann curvature tensor. So that's what you calculate here. Yeah. So you take a plane in this very high dimensional manifold, and then you calculate the standard Riemannian curvature in this plane locally.
Okay. So with a metric, I can compute the curvature. That's clear. But
yeah.
Can you remind me what was the starting physical meaning of this metric? Why are
okay? So we put a metric on the SUN manifold. So basically, what's happening is so this SUN is the manifold of unitaries. Yes, and so these unitaries act on, let's say, this n level system. Yeah.
Because we need to say when we are reaching
exactly. Exactly. And so some directions, let's say if this is the unit operator, some directions are easy to reach and some are harder to reach. And we've chosen one that I will show you in a second that descends from the Laplace.
Because we need to define what complexity is.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. So this is not enough. And
then just curiosity. So, and if you had chosen the Haar measure, what would this plot look like?
That's a very good question.
Haar measure is just spherical.
The Haar measure is positively curved everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Haar measure is not a good measure for this. You know, it's not a good choice for building a quantum computer. It doesn't penalize any direction. Okay, good.
What's the experimental significance of this metric?
It's not. Yeah, it's more like, okay, you know, you want to build your quantum computer with your existing technology, and then you kind of know in the lab which gates are easy to implement and which are harder. So you have to distribute these penalty factors. Yeah. I mean, this is really just control theory for a quantum computer that Wiedersen has been doing, that we are doing. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Good. So it turns out that there is another notion of curvature that one can compute, which has which allows you know, a little more, which allows better a better answer to the question whether we are chaotic or ergodic. And this is this so-called normalized Ricci curvature. So this is the following. So the definition is here. Basically what's happening is so if you have your geodesic motion here, let's say in the tangent space on the unit operator, then you fix one direction. So in order to pick out one plane and hence calculate one section on curvatures, you need two vectors, you need two directions. Here you just fix one direction and then orthogonal one, but then you average the sectional curvatures over all these directions. This is the second that are given by the second vector. So you're basically averaging over all the planes that include this first vector here. Okay. And then so what's happening is there's a mathematical result that tells you that if all of these normalized Ricci curvatures are negative, then this is a necessary condition for ergodicity. Okay, so this is it, for example, explained in this book by Arnold and Kaysen, where we took a lot of these mathematical results from. And the other reason why we started calculating this normalized Ricci curvature is that there is as I'm going to explain in the next slide, what's going to happen is in our particular choice of basis, the SUN algebra in the large n limit actually becomes isomorphic to the algebra of volume preserving vector fields on a torus. Okay, and so this is usually called S-vect of T2. So these are vector fields that are Hamiltonian in the sense that they fulfill a Liouville theorem. And so the group, in fact,
you're representing
the sphere. That depends on the choice of basis. Yes, you're right. So that's a good question.
You could get any genus if you take even real.
So sorry?
You can get any genus.
You can get any genus, yes. Yeah, I think that's a good question. So we've basically probably it doesn't really matter because it's on the level of the algebra, right? But you will see that so one can probably play similar games with the higher, with all the other genii as well. We started taking the torus because we used this particular convenient algebra, basically. So at the end, the SUN manifold in this choice of basis is isomorphic to in the large n limit n goes to infinity, is isomorphic to this group of volume preserving diffeomorphisms on T2. And so now there is an old result by a Russian mathematician from the 1940s, actually, Lukacsky, who has shown that these average, these normalized Ricci curvatures are all negative or zero for this S diff of T. He takes the same metric as we have. Yeah. No. So he takes the same metric as we have. Yeah. Good. So what we wanted to understand is now, if you start with finite n and you make n large, how do you approach? So how do you approach this, this result here at infinite n? And so here, what we found is summarized in this density plot here. So basically what happens is, as you make n larger, yeah, you will get more and more generators of the algebra coming in, yeah. And these generators, as I will explain this in the next slide, these generators are labeled by a vector in the integer lattice, in a unit cell in the integer lattice Z2. Okay, and so the new generators that come in, they always come in at rather high values of the components of this vector. This is this M1 and M2 here, and they start out having positive normalized Ricci curvature, and then as you increase n further, they start turning negative. Yeah, and so this is the way how you approach this infinite n result. You basically keep on getting more and more first positively curved directions, but then they turn negative. So if you take n to infinity, then you will most probably approach this result. Yeah. Yeah, so there it looks good for ergodicity, at least for this necessary condition here. So now let me explain the relation to hydrodynamics. So let me first summarize. So we found good evidence for ergodicity. I will give you an even stronger statement in a second. But let me first explain the relation to hydrodynamics. So basically what we've done here is, as Laurent already kind of anticipated, we've chosen a particular basis. And so there are two basically unitary matrices, G and H, in SUN that we've chosen. So I will not give you the particular form here. I can show it later. This is called the shift and clock basis. So there's one of these matrices is basically, okay, maybe I can write it down. So one of these matrices here is basically just has the roots of unity on the diagonal and otherwise zero. So this starts out with one, and then there's e to the, so this is in for SUN, and there's e to the I 2 pi k over n. And then there is e to the I, so 2 pi over n, and then there's 4 pi over n, and so on. So these are just, it is basically filled up with the roots of with the kth roots of unity here. And the other one is the so-called shift matrix, which is basically zeros on the diagonal, then it has ones on the off diagonal and zeros again. So the physical meaning in a sense is that so these two matrices, they generate the whole SUN algebra in this particular way here. And so you see that there are two integers involved, these powers M1 and M2. So at the end, each element in this basis is labeled by a Z2 vector M. Okay. And so the C2 vector M has to be chosen from a unit cell here, basically because these powers here cannot grow very large due to the fact that if you take G, if you take G to a particularly high power, then you reproduce the original some lower power of G and also for H. So at the end, your SUN algebra elements are labeled by these vectors chosen from a particular unit cell. So this is for n equals to 5 here. And now we've chosen a particular inner product here in this algebra. So this is basically the inner product between two such algebra elements is given by a normalization, convenient normalization times the trace of J Laplacian on this lattice times J. The Laplacian is just there to pull out minus n squared here, minus n absolute value squared. So this is our choice of metric basically. Yeah. Why do we choose the Laplacian? Well, I mean, there is a way of thinking about these basis elements here as being non-commutative plane waves on a non-commutative torus. I will not go into this, and then the Laplacian is just bringing down minus the wave vector squared of these plane waves. Yes?
Basic condition.
Okay. Yeah.
How are we describing all elements of SUN with just the two dimensional vector?
No, this is the algebra element. So this is in the algebra. So and the statement is that you can build the algebra of SUN from these two matrices, to the powers M1 and M2.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of them looks like a group element, but the other one.
They are both by themselves unitary matrices, but this is just a way to write down the algebra basis. Yeah. similar things have been done in the past on with other bases. Like, so there is this fuzzy sphere that people discussed a lot in the 90s and early 2000s, which I think you were thinking about.
They work by, you know, the metric sediment, two integers.
Yeah.
These two integers are points on a fuzzy sphere, and then
the sphere becomes commutative. Yeah, exactly. So just take it as a particular choice of basis for the SUN algebra. Okay. So now here comes the point that makes the relation to hydrodynamics. So if you now calculate the algebra in this basis, then you find that structure constants have this sinusoidal or of the sinusoidal type. So they involve this cross product, two-dimensional cross product of these vectors M and N. Okay. And in the N going to infinity limit, if you assume that this cross product is not scaling as order n or n squared, you can expand the sign, and then you know you just take the linear approximation, and then you can rescale your jm and jn generators by 1 over n basically in and times the generator of a particular volume preserving Hamiltonian vector field on torus. Okay, so xm is basically the Hamiltonian represents the Hamiltonian vector field associated with a single plane wave on the torus with wave vector m. Okay. So if you now go ahead and see what happens with this algebra, well, this algebra then becomes the algebra of these Hamiltonian vector fields on the torus. Now the algebra of Hamiltonian vector fields on the torus is exactly the algebra of symmetries of a two-dimensional ideal incompressible fluid on the torus. Yes, so if you have fluid flow described by the Euler equation on the torus, then there is a Liouville theorem. So you basically your vector fields are incompressible for the ideal fluid, and so the symmetry is basically this algebra. Okay, so this is the relation to two-dimensional ideal hydrodynamics. Furthermore, we have been able, I will not go through into the details here, we have been able to use the so-called Euler-Arnold formalism for the geodesic motion on the SUN to show that the version of the geodesic equation, I can give you details later, the so-called Euler-Arnold equation simply becomes the Euler equation for the stream function here. This F is the stream function associated to this vector field on the torus. Yeah, so there is the direct rewriting of the geodesic equation in this Euler-Arnold formulation in terms of the hydrodynamic equations on the torus. Yeah.
So the algebra depend on the choice of metric, right?
This algebra here does not depend on the choice of metric, but the equation that you get here and the Euler-Arnold equation that depends on the choice of metric.
Like any infinity is like independent of.
Yeah, but you get different equations at the end here for the geodesic motion. Yes. Okay, so this is the main result that we obtained about this large n limit of Q-dit complexity. I would be very happy to discuss with you guys what to do with this, because right now we have this result, and how does this help us further to go further in understanding, let's say, holographic complexity and so on. I think there are surely ways to proceed. Let me point out, before I come to the symmetry resolved entanglement part of the talk, let me point out two more things. The first thing has already been stated by Laurent. Basically, if you play this business at finite n, then you actually also get a version of hydrodynamics, but now in a non-commutative torus. So there is a relation to non-commutative geometry as well. And the other thing is, again, related to ergodicity. So if at basically what's happening is if when we expand these structure constants here, we are basically infinitely penalizing, right? So we make a large n expansion and arrive at this result here, we are infinitely penalizing all the directions where m cross n is of order n or n squared. Okay. And there is a whole field of mathematics that deals with Riemannian geometry where you have metrics that are infinitely infinite in some directions. This is the field of sub-Riemannian geometry. And in fact, there are hard results there that apply to our case here. Namely, there is the so-called Chaurashevsky theorem. So if you want to read up on this, you can, for example, look at this paper here. And the Chaurashevsky theorem basically states that under certain technical assumptions that are given in this case, a geodesic on such a sub-Riemannian geometry, where you can only go in some directions and at each point in a tangent space, can still reach all points in finite time. So there's basically an ergodicity result in such situations. Yeah. So this applies at infinite n, and so we are actually, so we know that the ergodicity must hold here. Yeah. Good. Are there any questions about this part? Any further questions?
The global structure.
The global structure, yeah. That's a good question. So you're basically saying, what about the conjugate points? Yeah, yeah. They do exist. In this limit, they are not described in they're not in the hydrodynamic formulation, right? Because you basically, when you do this expansion here, you basically keep on moving close to the identity. Yeah. So this rewriting basically applies to basically the directions where m cross n is order one, so you're staying close to the identity in the large n. Yeah? How far you can go is a quantitative question. Okay, good. So if there are no further questions, then let me go on with the second part of my talk. So here we go back a step, I want to explain to you what the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy is. So basically the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy is the following. So imagine you have your entanglement entropy in your quantum system with additional conserved charges. Yeah. Then you can ask the question, basically, what is the entanglement in a fixed subsector, charge subsector? Yes. So this is what the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy is. So let's say if you have a U1 charge operator around, then in your favorite quantum field theory, then by Noether's theorem, you can split this into a charge operator in your entangling interval and a charge operator acting outside of your entangling interval. And if you work with an eigenstate of Q, so with a density matrix which is commutes with Q, then you can quickly show that the reduced density matrix also commutes with the reduced charge operator, which means that your reduced density matrix admits this block decomposition. Okay, and then the symmetry resolved Rényi and entanglement entropies are just the Rényi and entanglement entropies for one of these blocks. Okay, yeah, so you just define them in the usual way. This was our starting point, and we wanted to understand how to do the symmetry resolved entanglement in ADS CFT. Yeah. But before going there, let me explain to you a little bit in physical terms what this means. So basically, there is a decomposition of the ordinary entanglement entropy here in terms of these symmetry resolved entanglement entropies and a classical Ibs entropy. So PA here are the probabilities to measure charge Q. The charge in the basically you're measuring the eigenvalues of the subregion charge operator Q here, and there is a probability distribution attached to that, and these are these probabilities here. So this is the classical entropy attached to this probability distribution, and then this other piece here is basically the symmetry resolved entanglement weight with these probabilities, and altogether you can build up the ordinary entanglement entropy in this way. So basically, this classical piece here encodes the entropy in charge fluctuations between the two subsystems. Yeah, so you have your subsystem that you're considering and the other one that you're tracing out. They're before tracing out. There definitely should be charge fluctuations here, and since you kind of already fixed the charge here to one subsector, you have these classical correlations and basically an entropy attached to them. And the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy tells you what is basically the leftover entanglement between the inside and outside while you keep the charge in your subsystem fixed. Okay. Good. So as an example, maybe very quickly, if you take the EPR state here, you know the normal entanglement entropy is log 2. And you can now basically take your conserved charge to be the occupation number of Alice qubit here. And if you calculate the symmetry resolved entanglement entropies with respect to this occupation number, then you get zero. There's no, none. Why? Because, well, in a sense, you've already measured the number, basically the value of your conserved charge, namely the value of Alice's qubit. So there's only this classical fluctuation piece left over. Yeah. So you kind of start, you start making measurements of this particular charge, and then and then you're just measuring the quantum correlations in one charge second. So what we've done in these works that I want to present you the results of, we basically wanted to understand in a simple setup what is the symmetry solved entanglement in ADS CFT. And so one of the simple setups you can use is ADS 3 CFT2. There we know how to calculate the ordinary entanglement entropy via the replica trick and so on. And now you need an additional conserved charge. So what we've done is we've basically used in the first two papers, we used the U1 Kac-Moody symmetric CFT. Yeah. So basically, there is an energy momentum tensor around that generates a Virasoro symmetry, and then there's an additional conserved current of dimension one. And together, the modes of these two operators form this U1 Kac-Moody algebra that you, I guess you're very familiar with. So the important point is that the modes of the current J with J, they do not commute. There's the simple extension is given by this Kac-Moody level K. Okay. Yeah. So in a sense, this is the simplest thing you could start with. Yeah. So also the holographic dual to these Kac-Moody symmetric CFTs is known. So basically, it's Einstein gravity for the energy momentum part. And then in order to generate this conserved current on the boundary theory, you have to actually add a Chern-Simons term. And also it's parity. So you need two Chern-Simons terms. You need a gauge field and its parity dual so that you keep, you don't break parity in the bulk here. So you have to add two Chern-Simons terms in the bulk. Yeah. And then this gauge field here is dual to, let's say one gauge field is dual to this conserved current, and the other gauge field is dual to the anti-holomorphic conserved current. And so the asymptotic symmetry analysis known as this case, and indeed the boundary theory does have this U1 Kac-Moody symmetry. So so now what we've done in this first paper here with my PhD student Suting Zhao, a postdoc Christian Norte, who is now moving to Israel, actually to Shiro Chapman's group, is the following. So we've done two things. So first of all, we've looked at the symmetry solved entanglement entropy in the 2D Kac-Moody symmetric CFTs. And so basically the idea of proceeding here is as follows. This was basically described in a paper by Sela and Goldstein in 2008. Basically, in order to implement the projection to a single charge sector in your entangling interval, you have to basically attach a charge to your twist operator in the twist field picture. Yeah, and so basically what's happening is that this charge twist operator then induces a flux as you go around here the entanglement endpoints with whatever operator you're looking at. And this flux can be translated into the charge projector. Okay, so what you have to figure out is what is this charge twist operator, and we did this in our paper. Technically speaking, what you have to do is you have to show that this twist operator is primary, and you have to calculate the charge of this twist operator as a function of the chemical potential dual to the
charge or measures charge.
It has charge itself. It has a charge. Yeah. I don't have time to go into the details now, but I can. You have Kac-Moody and you have Virasoro. You have this full algebra.
The symmetry you fix, the reduced symmetry.
No, I only fix the charge. What I fix in the entangling interval is U1 charge is the integral of J0. That's what I fix. No, we don't fix. So I don't fix the energy for example, the scaling dimension. I don't do. You could do that. It's a good question. Yes, it's an open problem. What's happening then? Yeah, it's not done. Yeah. So I can tell you, and I don't want to keep you from lunch. I can tell you over lunch, basically, the technical details of this construction. Let me just say for now that these, you know, the Cauchy calibrated twist operators acquire a charge. Okay, and the charge is given. Okay, so they acquire a charge. Okay, so then the replica trick goes through as usual. You can calculate the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy in the fixed charge sector. And this is what you find. You find the ordinary Cauchy-Calabrese result. And then there is a second piece here, which is subleading in both the large central charge and also the large interval length expansion. L is the interval length. L is basically the length of the real Takayanagi geodesic. So this subleading piece is the non-trivial piece in the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy. And there is an interesting fact happening that you can observe here. Basically, it doesn't depend on the charge at all that you've chosen. Okay, so this is called equipartition of entanglement. So, so this happens in, you know, all, there are many theories that have this symmetry, free fermions, free bosons. So basically, it's known that the symmetry of entanglement entropy does not depend on the charge that you've chosen in these theories, and that's a result from the that comes from the Kac-Moody symmetry. So the other thing that we've done is we figured out what is the object that you need to add in the bulk to calculate this symmetry resolved entanglement entropy. And so basically, Seyler and Goldstein put forward is basically that there is a what's happening is that you have an Aharonov-Bohm flux for charged operators as you go around this entanglement interval, and this Aharonov-Bohm flux is generated by these charged twist operators. Now, what object do you have in the bulk that generates such an Aharonov-Bohm flux on the boundary? Well, you can do that, for example, by pulling a charged Wilson line along the Rio Takayanagi geodesic here. That will generate this Aharonov-Bohm flux. Yeah? And it turns out that this is exactly the correct object that you need to add in order, without going into any detail, in order to generate this piece here in the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy. Yeah. So we've done a couple of further checks since I'm running out of time. How much more minutes do you grant me, Sabrina? It's true. So very quickly, okay. So we've done a couple of further checks in the second paper with a very, very good master student, Konstantin Weisenberger. Namely, we've also added uncharged and charged heavy primary insertions and calculated the symmetry resolved entanglement entropy both in the field theory and the gravity side. They all match. Yeah, so this is a good test of our proposal on the holographic side here. And we also looked at two intervals in the ground state. And there it turns out that also this Wilson line actually makes this phase transition, like, as you know, from the Rio Takayanagi geodesic. There's also a story about, you know, about the equipartition of entanglement in W3 symmetric CFTs and hence in SL3 or higher spin gravity in the bulk, but I will skip that for now. So let me just conclude. So basically, I've shown you two the results of these two basically several works. One was about this quantum computational complexity in the large n limit. So there we basically found that with our particular choice of metric, we can fulfill the requirements of ergodicity and conjugate points, and we also could rewrite the geodesic motion in terms of hydrodynamics. And then I've shown you these results about symmetry resolved entanglement entropy, which basically show that you know, we can translate this concept into the ADS side of the correspondence, and we can find basically agreement between the corresponding CFT calculations and our ADS prescription. So this is some kind of new test of the ADS CFT correspondence in the presence of these additional conserved charges. So, and if you want to know more about the details, in particular the second part and about the higher spin symmetry, ask me over lunch.
The talk, if there's any further questions, we can take some now, but we can also bother over lunch. So let's do that.
Yeah, maybe over lunch.